Welcome to Holy Village. Today in the fireside room is Gary Simpson, and he will be speaking on participatory ethics in public spaces. So let's listen in on Gary Simpson.
Somebody yesterday said that I was painting a bleak picture. To me, I didn't think it was quite that bleak, but they thought so. What's that?
You're dealing with the facts.
Something like that, yeah.
Now you have all the answers today.
How many of the rest of you eating ice cream cones? You made it.
I made it. 1 hour flat.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
So how fast can you make it up that? 35 minutes?
I did it 31 minutes.
Man. 31 minutes? No, I think I could make 35. I didn't have to stop with my daughter on the way.
You know how young he is?
Mm-hmm.
You can tell the stories. I'm 6 months older than my brother's.
No. I can't wait to know what you do.
No, don't. He was a marathon runner, you know? Was.
He tried.
Good.
I never passed her, you know. He was... I can't believe I'll be doing for him for that milkshake.
Well, what I intend to do today, remember yesterday, for those of you who were here yesterday, and you weren't, you know, it's not necessary, but we did our two 1776s. I'm going to draw a picture that looks more like Mickey Mouse, I think. 2 years. There's actually, there was a third book written in 1776 that was quite famous too by Thomas Paine. It was called Common Sense. And today I'm really going to talk about communicative sense. And sometimes I put that other 1776 down here. And I call this the life world. This is where most of us live in our families and our lives of intimacy and friendships with one another. And one of the things I was saying yesterday is that these two great mega institutions, these two great mega systems, this is the new politia, we call it power, and this is the new kind of oikonomia, we can call it money, are the media by which these two things work. Strategic power, we should call it strategic power. And money. One of the things they tend to do is flatten out this public sphere. Or this public space, I think I called it in today's. And with that public space, which is traditionally where moral thinking and moral reasoning and moral argumentation and moral traditions happen, these kind of mediating institutions that mediate between these huge institutions, these mega institutions, and our individual and private and life world worlds, is then our life world becomes rather fragmented. And we experience things like meaninglessness and all kinds of other types of things. And we could spend a lot of time, because what happens is the pressure of these two big mega systems bears down. And since there's not much in here to mediate it, these arrows kind of all go in one way. And one little example, sometimes I call this the colonization of the life world by these two mega structures. Somebody was talking to me yesterday afterwards, she's a small business owner, about how how the political area of strategic power has so colonized their businesses, their small businesses, that they can, by regulations and all kinds of regulations and things like that, they can hardly afford to stay in the business. And so she's real skeptical about what kind of health care there's going to be and if it's going to be. And so this is all part of the health care debate as well. Some of you may be at least as, if not more, worried about what happens this way. With everything turns into a commodity. And even art and sometimes religion and theology and church and those things turn into a commodity, and you end up with a lot of consumerism.
I got mine. How did you make mine?
Things like that, right? I remember as a pastor in Portland, Oregon, that reminds me of a little story. I was driving down on the right-hand side of the street down on a 35-mile-an-hour speed limit, and I was going about 35 miles an hour or so. And all of a sudden, in my rearview mirror on the side, I could see a woman coming up kind of slowly, and I could see a car coming up. And then when she got next to me, she was going just about the same pace as I was, just a little bit faster. And she was riding in a pretty big car. It turned out to be either a big Cadillac or Lincoln Continental, I can't remember, with all the gold trim. It was kind of interesting, neat little car, a neat big car. And then in Oregon, you can have personalized license plates. And when she drove by, and the personalized license plate on the back said, "My turn." And I thought, yeah. The colonization of the life world, the biggest example for me is we try to run a rather egalitarian, maybe feminist household, where we have three daughters and try to bring them up empowered as daughters and as women, not to feel inferior to men and to boys and things like that. But with all that we tried to bring them up, the thing that there's probably more Barbie dolls around our household than there's anything else, and I always couldn't quite figure out how that all happened. Since I hated Barbie dolls, and so did my wife, and a lot of times what they represent. And what you realize is that with marketing and advertising, this comes down, and it's really difficult because the pressure on kids to do that kind of thing, the pressure is not only on kids, as we all know, it's on all of us. And so my daughter, what happens over here is one of the things that the pressure of money does and the economy does, our kind of economy does, is it turns all of our wants into needs, or our desires into needs. And so my daughter says, I need a new pair of pants. Yeah, you do. And then she says, well, I need these kind of pants with this little design on it, you know. And those kind of pants cost $95, of course. and she said, well, but I really, then she ups the ante, she turns up the volume, she says, but I really need those, Daddy. And I say, no, you need pants. You really want those kind because of the pressures, of peer pressures, and what that all means. The strategy that I would like to suggest is that, and I suggested that a lot of churches and church people in the mainline denominations, and then in the 80s, the right-wing Christian communities all followed in the same track and actually were a little bit more successful, but not terribly successful, interestingly enough. Is they went from churches, which are kind of part of the public sphere in a certain sense, but really tried to end run. And through bureaucrats and fundraisers and people in Washington, D.C., and people in Chicago at Higgins Road, and sometimes people at seminaries, and occasionally one or two people, maybe even in a synod, trying to impact the politia directly. And a couple of things often happen. These people become often disconnected from people in the pews, and they become in their own way kind of prophetic elitists. And sometimes they're bureaucrats and managers, and there's kind of various, we could spend a lot of time talking about that. Personally, I think that strategy hasn't worked very well, because mostly they haven't impacted up here very much anyway. And what they've often done is alienated a lot of the ordinary people that are that sit in church on Sunday mornings as well. The strategy that I'm going to propose is that we learn to think about this public space and to try to pump up it, because it's in the public spaces where I think public moral reasoning and argumentation go on. But I don't think just any kind of public spaces or any kind of mediating institutions or any kind of moral reasoning is good enough. And so one of the things that I'm going to propose is today, and I'm interested to see what you all think about, is a certain, and I'm probably going to be more theoretical today than I've been in the past. In the past, I've been a little bit more historical and telling historical narratives. Today, I'm going to try to open up a little bit in less than an hour's time. Two or three of the strongest ethical traditions, and most of us come out of one or the other of them, that have been in Western, at least Western Christian societies, and even Western secularized societies for the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. And we'll see if we can do that. And then I'll propose my own little proposal that I think in today's, as I labeled it up there, I call participatory ethics. And today I'm going to call it a little bit different. But you'll see why I call it participatory. In the West, going back a couple of thousand years at least, is a way of doing ethics called teleological ethics. And underlying this kind of ethics, this comes from a Greek word, telos, and it's really the word for end, E-N-D, or the goal, or the aim of something, the goal of something. And this kind of ethics actually had a vision, kind of a major metaphor or an image of what it means to be human. And it actually envisions the human creature, the ethical creature, the moral creature, as homo faber, the human being as maker. We get our nice English word, those are Latin words, of course. We get the word homogenize and like homosexuality and all kinds of words from homo. It really means human. And faber, we get a nice English word, fabricate, to make. So the kind of the image of the human person is that the human being is a maker. They used to say man the maker in the old days. The human as maker. And what that envisions is that human beings are creative creatures, that we create, that we make things and create things. And that what we do is we make things that are good. We try to make something good, a good thing. And the great comparison that the people who this ethical tradition talked about was, well, actually it happens around here. This is a great place to talk about teleological ethics, because when people made things 2,000 years ago in the West, and to this day in some kinds of cultures, more traditional or sacred canopy cultures, what do you make? What are you called? What kind of a person?
Craftsman.
A crafts person, a craftsman, a craftsperson. So craft. Crafts up here. Craft is kind of the way that people started thinking about the moral life. So that you would have something in mind, a good product, an end product, a goal in mind, like a piece of jewelry. And you would go down to the you would go find a stone, and you'd go down to the lapidary, and then you would make this craft. Or weaving.
Baskets.
Or pottery. So everything, and now they started thinking, well, the human moral life is like this as well. It is like a craft. Now, in order to be a good craftsperson, and therefore to have a good product at the end, what do you need to do? What kinds of things do you need to do?
Practice.
You need, that's the very next thing that I had written down. You need to practice.
You need raw materials?
You need materials. We're going to talk about that. Raw materials. Interesting that you said raw materials.
We may need teachers.
Oh, that's exactly right. Now, you don't really call them teachers.
Mentors.
You call them, not quite.
Masters.
What?
Masters.
Masters. Masters? Actually what we'll do is we'll move raw material around. What you actually have, in order to have practice, is you have a guild. And then the guild is made up of masters.
Apprentices.
And apprentices. And so, you know, still if you're a pipe fitter or something like this, it's the same kind of a philosophy every day. And because what happens, in order to have practice, you need a discipline.
You need the skill or the art itself.
Yes. Although you're not born with the skill, are you?
No, that has to be a given. I mean,
the skill, what you have is a potential.
I'm talking about the master must have.
The master. Oh, yes. The master is very important, isn't it? But in here, everybody has the potential. And the potential is kind of inside of you. Actually, the potential you're born with. But in order to get that potential out, you have to, first of all, strip away any roadblocks. And then you have to have somebody that apprentices you. And that's the master who has the knowledge and the skill and all kinds of things.
And the patience.
And the patience. Oh, patience. Why do you need patience?
Some people don't learn very well.
Some people don't learn very well. Hey, even folks who learn well, in fact, real good learners, we call them what kind of studies? Quick studies. Which means that it has to do with time, right? I mean, it takes time. So if you're going to be a bricklayer, you probably, the first, you know, you get out there your first day in the bricklaying, you know, I'm going to build a building.
Very hard.
Right. For the first 2 years, all you do is carry bricks from one place to the next. And then after your first 2 years, and they say, okay, you get out, you don't have to carry bricks, saying, all right, I get to lay the bricks. No, for the next 2 years, you got to stir the mud. 2 years you got to stir, just to get a feel for what the right mud is. And then only after about 4 years can you even lay a first brick. Then you have to learn all kinds of other things as well. It takes time, it's a tremendous amount of time in practice. Raw materials. Now, when it comes to ethics, if you're thinking about being a moral person, there are different kinds of versions of this. You might have a good in mind, like a good society. And so in ethics, what you do is you think of the big question is, what is the good? Or what are the goods that we want? What is the good thing to do? What is the good goal that you want to achieve? And then you figure out what kinds of practices and skills and also raw material. Well, you are the raw material. And there's a lot of potential in this raw material in my 7-year-old daughter. And so it's the master's thing to do that. Now, I remember one of the most interesting experiences of my life. And so, before saying that, so what you are crafting is yourself as a moral person. Yourself as a moral person. And in antiquity, this tradition was often called, was really in antiquity, was called virtue ethics. And today we sometimes call it character ethics. And so what they had was, there were certain virtues, and they spent a lot of time, the philosophers, thinking about the virtues, but then most of the people spent their time crafting themselves into these virtues. The virtues are potentially in each person, and what you have to do is bring them out into actuality. So the kind of whole big philosophy or cosmology of the world is potentiality and actuality. Now, one of the things I remember, let's see what else kind of things. This is usually a community character too. What happens is individuals don't make themselves into something unique. They make themselves into what the community was before. Actually, in a certain sense, the community shapes you into who you are, into a communal. So this is, today we often call these, by the way, communitarians. You've heard that word. In a certain sense, maybe a lot of folks here are communitarians, and some people envision Holden Village as a communitarian village, where you have a communitarian character, a communal character, and then that is passed on and apprenticed by the masters, who are the masters in the village, in the commune, in the community, and they apprentice the other people into that. And that's often done through stories, and you have masters and disciples and narratives. And in a certain sense, the biblical tradition has often been passed along that way, from one generation to the next. And in fact, the word tradition actually means to hand over, to hand down from one generation to the next. And so you hand down certain virtues and the shape of these virtues, and what you do when you raise your children, basically, and also raise your young adults, is you raise them into this tradition, into this virtuous character. Well, there's a lot of very excellent, a lot of my life as a parent, of course, is involved in doing exactly these kinds of things. There are some drawbacks. And gradually, people over the years identified a few drawbacks, not minor ones necessarily either, but some serious drawbacks. Now, one of the drawbacks I learned about, I kind of learned a picture of it the only time I went to Florence. First time I went to Europe, I went through Italy and Venice and Milan, but never got to Florence. And people said, well, what you did is you missed half the culture of Europe because you didn't get to Florence. So the second time I went back to Europe, I was with my wife the second time. First time I was in college in a choir tour. We decided that we were going to go to Florence because I actually had studied all that art history too. And you miss half the culture of Europe. So we got to Florence one day, and the big thing that we really wanted to do in Florence is go see Michelangelo's David. Everybody goes to see Michelangelo's David. So, we did some things in the morning, and then at the afternoon, I think we saw the cathedral, and then we went over to see the David, and we got there about 2:30 in the afternoon. And this is the most average, this is one of the greatest pieces of artwork in the world, obviously, of sculpture. And I've never quite figured out up to that time why anybody would be so taken back by any kind of sculpture. I'd seen some sculptures before in museums in the United States and things like that. But I decided, well, we better go see it anyway. We got there at 2:30, and you just go down kind of a normal street and with a lot of kind of row houses or buildings, and this one building looks like all the rest of them, and it's got a little door in the front, and that's where you're supposed to go. And I said, this doesn't look much like a museum. It just looks like a couple-story high building. And David, have you ever seen the David? Oh, well, then you're going to know it. And we got there at 2:30, and what does it say? Doggone, we were going to leave that night on the train. We had Eurail passes. Closes at 2 o'clock. Should we stay an extra night, come back and see this blankety-blank statue, or should we go on to wherever we're going? I think we're going to go up to Venice or something. So I said, man, if I miss this one more time, you know, I won't get back there for a while. So we stayed over one more night in the youth hostel. Got back the next day, and we came at 10 o'clock. The hours are only 10 to 2. I thought, gee, here's this famous statue, thousands of people coming to see it, and they show it only from 10 to 2. That's kind of stupid. Why don't they make the hours long?
Not a morning person.
Huh?
He's not a morning person.
He's not a morning person. Actually, neither a morning nor an afternoon person. And I'll tell you why in a minute. So we come back next day. We get there at 10 o'clock in the morning. get there just when it opens. And you come in this front door, and it's rather nondescript, and you come into this little hallway waiting room, and it opens into a hallway. And actually, it turns into it's an L-shaped hallway that goes this way and then turns to the left. You remember? And the hallway is probably about as wide as this, and the ceiling is not as high as this. The ceiling maybe goes up to, probably about as high as this ceiling is right here, maybe just a touch higher. And you come in, and the first thing you see, well, I'll tell you, what you do is you come in, and you look for the David, and it's not around, and you see some other kinds of statues, and I'll come back to these other statues in a minute. You go down, you make a left-hand turn. And then about 50 yards, you go down this other hallway that's about the same width as here, maybe even a little narrower. And you still can't see anything way down at the end of this room. You know, you're kind of looking down this hallway like this, and it's about this wide, and low ceiling. And you see a little bit of light down there, and a little bitty door. And you walk. And then you go through this pretty small door. But when you get a little closer, you see some feet, some little toes, some white toes. And you don't think anything of it until you come, you go through that doorway. And then all of a sudden, there's a rotunda there. And there's an opening in the ceiling. So it's natural light. That's why it's only open from 10 to 2 while the sun is high in the sky. And you go through that door, and wow, 15 feet high, almost as high as the ceiling. It's about the height of the ceiling. And comes down to about here, is this white marble that just, in the natural light, it almost knocks, there's no artificial light, almost knocks you over, doesn't it? It's breathtaking, for those of you who've seen it. It's really breathtaking. You think, wow, what a craft, and what a sculpture. What's interesting to me now, for the purposes of this, that's what it would mean to be a good person, to craft yourself in that same kind of way, and then to display yourself like that. Well, he didn't have any clothes on for it. You don't want to display yourself exactly like that, probably.
And it's bigger than life.
He is bigger than life. He's about 3 times bigger than life, almost.
People haven't seen him. 2 or 3. You get there to the toes and you don't tell me more, but that's not fair.
Oh, I did. I said he's 15 feet high. Just beautiful, and you can see all the veins in his arm. It's just tremendous. He didn't have any clothes on.
No, glowed.
Oh, glowed. It glowed, yes. He didn't have any clothes on, but it glowed. But what's interesting is, what do you see in this hallway all the way down on both sides?
It's the toes.
No, but when you're walking through this hallway,
you see
all these other little statues, smaller ones, and none of them are done. It's like Michelangelo got tired. Then none of them are finished. There's probably 50 of them that he has done, and none of them are done. You get a block of marble, and then you get a little carbon, and it's done. It's like, what do you do? Go on strike or what? Do you get sick? Do you get diarrhea or what? And then some of them, they're almost all done, and then he doesn't finish the one arm left or the foot or whatever it happens to be. What happened?
He lost his patience.
No.
Got another idea.
The marble. No.
Yeah.
No.
You couldn't get any.
Somebody said something about the marble.
The marble.
That's right. The marble has a flaw. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't foresee that. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't get around it. Mm-hmm. So you just quit. Yeah. There are some things just beyond our control.
And David's stance is done the way it is because of the flaw.
Yes, there was a flaw. He couldn't give that one up. I don't think when he started, it was really a great piece of marble. So what some people felt that one of the problems with the virtue tradition is that it runs into things beyond your control. And sometimes these things are in us. A lot of times they're just... Well, it's suffering, natural evil, sometimes social evil. We'll talk about that maybe too. But there's natural evil. There's things just happen that is beyond our control. And then what do you do? Because this system assumes that you are in control. But there are sometimes you run up against powers or situations or circumstances that are beyond your control. And the great one that's often come up, and that this other tradition I'm going to talk about has pointed out, is that suffering is beyond our control, and other human beings are beyond our control. So your own children may be within your control, but other children, other persons' children outside of your community are out of your control. And then what do? So you have suffering and you have things out of your control. I think that there's another problem in this tradition, and that's what I would call the problem of, well, this is master power. This is a tradition of master power. This is a... And the great thinker behind this tradition, of course, does anybody know who it is?
Yeah.
Aristotle. Yeah. He's the great secular Western thinker and philosopher, and, you know, tremendously brilliant. But this model of ethics and an ethical community turns out between masters and apprentices, so it's tremendously hierarchical. And so it was no problem for Aristotle. I mean, he did not think that there was any problem with having slaves and with having just a very few people run the world. And Plato and Aristotle, particularly Plato and his teacher, but Aristotle as well, they had a very hierarchical view of the world, you know, where you had the philosopher king at the top, and then you had worker bees. Actually, it was a very tripartite kind of thing. We don't have time to go into all that. There's a modern, the modern alternative, or the modern version of this, virtue ethic, antiquity, character, community tradition. They tried to work with some of these issues, and so they tried to pay attention to consequences. You can talk, consequences are like, you know, the end thing. What's the consequence? So it was called consequentialists, consequentialism. And then and what in modern times, when I talk about modern, I'm talking about since the 17th century, they were utilitarian tradition. And there's a little maxim, some of you remember, there's a little maxim behind the utilitarian consequentialist tradition. And it says, anybody remember this from your philosophy class or ethics or anything like that? It's called, you probably have heard of this. It actually makes a lot of sense. The greatest good for the greatest number of people. The greatest good for the greatest number. So this is kind of the modern version. And so you don't spend so much time talking about the virtues or characters per se, like the virtue of friendship or the virtue of fortitude or the virtue of wisdom. But you concentrate more on the consequences, on the good, and you try to reach the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Now there's a certain reasonability to that, reasoning. Right? You know, there's a certain kind of, you know, you try to get the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And today, that's it. Well, you do start to move into a majoritarian tradition where and you can actually move it into a democratic version of that. So the more people that vote for something, then you do that. What you always have then is what? Yes, or you really what you do have is a minority. You have somebody that are on the margins. You have somebody who's not in the greatest number. And they might be 49%. Now you notice that if something is the greatest good for 51%, that's not going to be a happy situation. If it's the greatest good for 80% of the people, you might have social stability. But you're always going to have 20% or, you know, whatever the percentage is, that's going to fall through the cracks or be on the margins. And so it's a center margin kind of ethics, where you can almost guarantee, unless everybody is exactly wants the greatest good, has the greatest, that there's going to be left out, people left out. But we do this a lot of times. In fact, medical ethics is tremendously utilitarian. So is business ethics, by the way. You know, you can serve as good for the greatest number of people. Profit margin is usually based on that basis. And there's a certain kind of reasoning built in here. When you put somebody on a life support system or don't put them on, what you usually ask is, what's the benefit, what's the burden? Cost benefits or burden benefits. So you'll hear a lot of kinds of talk in the next year or two in the healthcare debate between what's called cost benefit kind of thinking.
People use it called rationing.
Yes, and you have rationing. Right, which is rationing is the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Rationing is a version out of utilitarian tradition. And I can, you know, there's times when that seems to make the most amount of sense, you know. Should you spend $1 million for a special kind of liver transplant for an 80-year-old person? Or should you take that $1 million and spend it on 80,000 children to get them inoculated and better health care at a younger age? I mean, so you have these kind of cost benefits. Well, you ask, well, what's the benefit? And what's the cost? And so there is a kind of reason that goes along with it. That's one of the more popular modern terms. Actually, at least one part of our U.S. What time did we start at?
3:45.
Oh, jeez. Remember that. Go on, sit down. Then there's a contemporary version of this. Let's call it the contemporary version. And I'll call it EE, ethical egoism. The greatest good for me. Okay. And actually a lot of language that many of us maybe grew up with comes out of here. Self-actualization, self-fulfillment.
I got mine, how do you make out?
My turn. So a lot of self-actualization, self-fulfillment kinds of things. Highly individualistic. Now one of the things that's this tradition right today is really making it's on the upswing in our country and different parts of the world, primarily because one of the reasons, at least, is so many people have fallen in the last 30 or 40 years into this tradition. And this tradition is often, and I think this tradition is back on the upswing. For decades and decades, you didn't hear much about this tradition. In fact, Freud was fighting this tradition. And actually was promoting this one. Well, there is another great tradition in the West called the deontological tradition. And the great image, or the major metaphor, the root metaphor behind this tradition is Homo politicus, the human being as citizen. And one of the things that it really realized is that too many things are outside of your control over here. And also, when it came to the modern tradition, that the utilitarians left too many people out, and it's the greatest good for the greatest number. Well, it helped the greatest number, but it may not have been the greatest number of people, but you could have large numbers of people on the left outside. And so this tradition developed, particularly in the modern period. There were some traditions in antiquity, but particularly in the modern period, they ask not so much what is the good, but what is the right thing to do? Or what is the just thing to do? So this is the justice tradition, interestingly enough. And it often pays attention not to the greatest good for the greatest number of people, because you might say, well, the greatest good for the greatest number of people is if we knock off that 20%. Just, you know, for whatever reason.
Good try.
Or we put them in an internment camp, or we wreck the final solution. Mm-hmm. Is the greatest good for the greatest number. And what you do is make the greatest good for everybody. And if you have to knock off some of the... So then this is the rights tradition. And ask what is the right thing to do, and has developed the notion of rights, civil rights, political rights, human rights, and it's often associated with the justice tradition. Homo politicus, the great image is not a craft, but what? Everybody lives in a city. And what do you have in a city? How does a city run?
Laws.
So what you do is you have law. And what law does is equal for everybody, and so this is a great egalitarian tradition. over against a hierarchical tradition, much more of egalitarian. The law, everybody is supposed to be under the law and impartiality, you know, and so in this tradition, you have traditions of justice is blind, you know, it's not partial towards certain people, so you have impartiality. The laws are given, and then what you have to do is obey them. So obedience. Sometimes, so you start to see a little bit some of the visions of this tradition. You often have actually obedience, or what deons means is duty or obligations. That's what this word means. Deons. This word means the end or the goal. This all means obligation or duties.
Personal responsibility.
Yes, in a certain sense. Because I'm going to throw up a third tradition here. In a certain sense, you have responsibility. What you do is you're responsible to do what you're told. And so you can see, what are some of the problems that come up with the deontological tradition?
Rebellion.
What's that?
Rebellion.
Rebelling? Authoritarianism. Who makes the rules and how are they made? And so the great thinker in this tradition tried to answer that question. His name was Immanuel Kant, and he came up with what he called the categorical imperative. And it was really a version of some very old principles in the West. This categorical imperative went something like, I'll say it quickly, act on that maxim by which you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. In other words, you should do, your duty is to do whatever you could think should be everybody's duty. So note it's an egalitarian principle. It's really kind of a more philosophically stated kind of thing than do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that's what he was inspired by. Do unto the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So it's inspired by the golden rule. Equal respect, equality is involved in that. Ten Commandments are like that. What's often easy to do is to come up with negative duties, though. Well, the Ten Commandments are mostly like that, huh? Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Because most of the things that would be universal, they would say, are negative things, that you should not violate somebody else's rights. So that the rights and the duties are on opposite sides. You have rights, and then the other person has the duty not to infringe on your right to have your life, or to have your property, or to have a spouse. Now, some of the weaknesses are, who makes the laws, and you get authoritarianism, and how are they made, the processes. Kant actually tried to do this. You notice this is a way to test. This is a testing procedure, isn't it? The golden rule. The golden rule doesn't exactly tell you what to do, does it? Doesn't tell you what to do, huh? So it's a way to test. Okay, I want to go 60 miles an hour in this, in my neighborhood, in my car. Well, how would I test that? Well, I should do unto others, drive 60 miles an hour in their neighborhood as I would have them to drive in my neighborhood. If I want them to drive 60 miles an hour in my neighborhood, no. So it's a testing procedure. It's a rule. It's a rule in order to test what kind of duty obligation we would have to one another. What I wanted to do is, just think about this rule for a second. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. What's the first thing you do in this rule, in this testing procedure? How would you test something? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The first thing you would do is you would kind of look into yourself, right? How do I want people to treat me? How do I want to be treated? And then what you do is you project that out onto everybody else. And you treat them that way. Now, I've done that. Let's see. I would like to be treated, you know, well, I'm a professor in a seminary. I would like to be treated, I'd like to be paid according to my IQ. And therefore, I'll pay everybody else according to their IQ. Go to others. Pay them.
Yeah.
By how you'd like to be paid. Fair? That fits the golden rule. What's wrong with it? It fits the golden rule perfectly. It fits the test of the golden rule. You could do that with anything, you know. I would like to be treated according to my color of my eyes or the kind of genitals that I have. We'll, right? And I'll treat you according to yours.
Well, it depends on culture, too. Some people wouldn't want to be treated like you like to be treated.
Oh, really?
Certainly.
Actually, you're right. Then that's true, isn't it? So so is there something wrong with the golden rule? Actually, there is. Well, one of the things I'm...
Assumes we're all the same.
Huh?
Assumes we're all the same.
It does. It assumes, and it works quite well. It works extremely well in a highly homogenous society. Where most everybody is mostly alike. And Kant was one of the most brilliant people of all time. Never left, never even went on a vacation outside of this little place called Königsville, Germany. Couple thousand people. And he never left this little village his whole life. Wrote some of the most brilliant treatises of all time. It was a highly, highly homogenous. And most people, most of the time, lived in rather homogenous places. And in a homogenous place where everybody is mostly alike, the golden rule fits to a T.
So compare Japanese economy and society with U.S. society. Yes.
So as soon as you move into a pluralistic situation, you run into all kinds of trouble with the golden rule. Well, what I'm going to suggest is that the golden rule really has some very important basic intuitions, basic moral intuitions correct. It's one basic moral intuition it has is that there are duties, there are things that we ought to do, and that these are rather universal. It also, because it believes in oughts, it believes that there is something called moral truth, and it tries to have a test for what that is. And a part of the test is that you switch places with everybody, with other people. So there's an intuition of reversibility. You take somebody else's, you put yourself in their shoes. The problem with the golden rule is you do it in your own imagination. In other words, it's a testing procedure that has the intuition of reversibility, but it does it in a moral monologue. It's like, not Johnny Carson, what's his name? It's like all the monologue, the on TV, the comedians. Yeah, Garrison Keillor. So it doesn't work in highly pluralistic places or in places that are highly conflictual, oftentimes because of pluralism. Which brings me to the last 10 minutes for my proposal. Maybe we'll have to come back to it tomorrow a little bit too. I'm sorry, on Saturday, which is what I actually had thought to do. What I am going to try to do is, I'm not the first one that's done this, but actually I'm trying to do it as strongly as anybody these days, is to wedge a third tradition in here, a third major tradition. These are all kind of branches out of this tradition. And there are a couple different branches that in this tradition, we'll go into those. It's what I will call the RC tradition. Now let's see if they can get this thing to work here. R stands for responsibilist. And there was somebody 40 or 50 years ago now who actually, let's see if I can project it up on this, without being clean. Nope.
Pull down the screen.
I can do this quicker, I think.
Pulling down the screen.
I'm pulling down the one, I have to move that back and readjust it. Oh, here, pass these around as well. what I will call, what in the title I call participatory ethics.
Just a quiz?
Nope. It's what in the title I call participatory ethics in public spaces. And these are, and it's the kind of approach that I would like to see going on in these public spheres, these public locations. Oops, the top thing didn't make it. Somebody want to give me, is there any answers? I'm going to keep this one of those. Thank you. Oh, you're up there. The responsibilist communicativist tradition is, it's as far as theorizing or thinking about it, it's a rather new tradition. But I think it goes back several hundred years, if not longer, in the West. I'm not sure about other places, and I'd like to follow that out sometime. The responsibilist tradition was actually thought about by this guy named Niebuhr in about 30 or 40 years ago. His name was H. Richard Niebuhr. There were two Niebuhrs, the famous one, the other one. The most famous was his older brother, Reinhold Niebuhr. And was a great thinker, was one of the Christian thinkers who was behind the new Roosevelt's New Deal. H. Richard Niebuhr was his younger brother and wrote a book called The Responsible Self. And in there, he begins to think through these two great traditions, both their strengths and their weaknesses. And he also thinks that there is something more basic in human beings than either one of these images, these root metaphors of the human as maker or the human as citizen. He doesn't think that those are wrong necessarily, but he thinks that there's something more basic at the root of human people, of human creatures, and he called it responsibility. And he's got kind of a long definition. This is a short thing. In order to be responsible, we should respond to all actions upon you so as to respond to God. And we can't go much into that. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the responsibilist tradition. Earlier in the summer, there was a man here, an African-American ethicist. His name is Daryl Trimmie. At least he was supposed to be here. Was he here, those of you who have been around during earlier in the summer, in June? Anybody here from June? Nobody here from June. Well, he's written a book that I use for my classes called Voices of the Silence, and the subtitle is The Responsibilist Tradition in Marginalized Society, in Marginalized Communities. And he tries to take the responsibilist tradition and say, what would that tradition look like for African Americans? And he has three case studies that he looks at. H. Richard Niebuhr talked about, instead of asking what is the good thing to do, or asking what is the right thing or the just thing to do, the first thing that humans ask is what is the fitting thing to do? Because that at the root of human beings is not human beings as makers, although we make things and we are creative, nor as citizens, although we do obey laws and we have obligations and duties to one another. But the first thing we do, even more basic than that, is we dialogue with each other. So the root metaphor is homo dialogicus, the human being as communicator, as what he said, responder to others. And he went through four kind of movements or moments in this that he called you response. In order to have an ethical action, an ethical agent or an ethical person, you respond to an action that's upon you. So it's always secondary. And in order to respond to an action, you have to interpret that your response in the light of other kinds of contexts. And we'd have to go into interpretation theory a little bit long time. You stay accountable to the other person. So when you receive an action upon you, you respond back to them, always with a view to how they are going to receive your response. So you remain accountable. So accountability is very important. And then he says you do that all within a continuing community of persons. He called that solidarity. Some of its intuitions is its other-orientedness. It is always oriented to other people. Others act first, and you respond, and you're always then thinking about their response to your response. And so it's other-oriented. It starts to prioritize cooperation rather than obedience, for instance. It's very context-sensitive. It spends most of its time correcting the deontological tradition, but it didn't think too much about the teleological tradition and the kinds of things like asking, well, what is the good thing to do and what are virtues and things like that. One of the things I've been doing is trying to think through this, the responsibilist tradition, which came out of H. Richard Niebuhr and others, primarily Niebuhr, and to think through what some people are calling through communicative ethics, or the communicativist tradition. And communicative ethics, or what I called up there in the title for today, participatory ethics, tries to build on some fundamental moral intuitions that we have in life. And one of the things, the more controversial claims of communicative ethics, is that there are some things, some moral intuitions that are rather universal. That, in other words, they cross cultural borders, they're cross-cultural. And they're not only specific to a certain culture, like, for instance, the West, or an African culture, or New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, or something like this, but there are certain things. And that these universal things are actually built into the nature of all human language. Of all human language. And so you have to think about the nature of human language. The first thing it builds upon is the intuition that it seems to be cross-cultural, that in every culture people say, you ought to do this, or you ought not to do this. And that there are oughts in life. And when would you say to somebody, you ought not to do this?
Talking with your mouth, but think table manners?
Table manners. Why? What's going on there?
Mores.
Mores. Now those are rather, they're important ones. You spend a lot of time at it in my table. But when might I turn up the volume on those oughts and say...
Endangering yourself or others.
Pardon?
Endangering yourself
or others. Ah, endangering yourself or others. You ought not, I might say, you ought to chew your food with your mouth shut to my daughter. Oh no, there's one there. And I do say that, don't I say that?
Yeah.
You ought to chew your food with your mouth shut, yes. But if her older sister was hitting her, then I would say to her, I would probably turn up the volume, maybe more than slightly, depending on how many times or how violent the act is, and say, you ought not to hit her that like that.
At all.
At all. And I probably would add an at all in there. Right? So, when people are vulnerable, so that first word, there's an intuition that human creatures are tremendously vulnerable to one another. And that violence is a part of human life and the potential for violence. And oughts have kind of in the other side of the coin of our vulnerability and of the violence that goes on between people. We have to spend a lot of time with it. Another moral intuition is that there's a reciprocity of respect. I think that was built into the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. There's an intuition that we ought to respect other people as we would like them to respect us. And kind of an reciprocity or an egalitarian respect. There's another intuition that is in communicative ethics that also is in the Golden Rule, and it's this reversibility. That we ought to reverse, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That there's something correct about this reversibility, this reciprocity. And the last one, there may be some other ones too, the last major one is that we ought to be impartial. And that also is part of the Golden Rule, that there's impartiality. What communicative ethics tries to do now is to build on these principles, on these intuitions, with four principles. At least I've kind of put these four principles together. They're not all my words, but I've kind of arranged them this way. And I'll try to do the first two principles, and then we're going to quit. In fact, time is just about up, actually. The first two principles go something like this. You need to look at it. Maybe I'll turn this off.
Probably take a while for that line to go off, so you can watch them on your paper. Do you have a piece of paper? Yeah, okay. The first one I call the discourse principle, or we might call it the participatory principle. Maybe you could call it the participatory principle. Only those norms, those oughts, can claim to be valid or claim to be true that meet or could meet with the approval of all affected, anybody affected by them, in their capacity as participants in a practical discourse. What it really says is that in order for an ought to be true, other people ought to participate in the deciding of that ought.